Hello. My name is Jake Stevens. I work at Nihilistic Software, and this is the use of realism in level design panel. On my right here is Paul Jakeways from id Software. he's worked on games like Quake 2, Quake 3 Arena. Next to him is Eric Biesman from Raven Software. He's worked on games like Elite Force, Soldier of Fortune, Heretic 2, Hexen. These guys, I think, will be representing the fantastic side of the argument. On my left here, we have Dario Casali from Valve Software. He's worked on games like Final Doom and Half-Life, and Half-Life Team Fortress, and Half-Life Game of the Year Edition, and Half-Life Gunman. And next to him is Duncan Brown, LucasArts Software. Duncan's worked on games like Jedi Knight, Mysteries of the Sith, Episode 1 Racer, and most recently Battle for Naboo. Okay, so I guess we'll start off with the fantastic side of the argument. And this is a versus debate, so we'll start with the first question being, start with Paul. What role, if any, do you feel your background played in the design of your most recent project?
Okay. First thing I have to explain is that my background goes back about 25 years in the industry, and it hasn't always been in computer games. I can probably trace my roots back to being a very small child and building worlds out of blocks and plastic toys, then going the next step and as you get older, you can't just fantasize play. You have to add rules. So I started making board games and writing my own miniatures rules. I got a question. Can people hear me? Is this picking up?
Yes.
Okay. My training, I studied to be an artist and actually became an illustrator. College life changed for me when I discovered Dungeons & Dragons. I know a lot of people probably had that experience, but Dungeons & Dragons had been around for a year when I found it. So it was like this epiphany that changed my life. I could see where I was going in my life and having it changed. After college, I moved on to, I actually worked in the fantasy role-playing game industry. Worked for some very small publishers as both a designer of paper RPG adventures, and then moved over into doing illustration for them at the same time. So it was a back and forth. I ended up through a happy accident at Coleco, where I started designing electronic games and eventually ended up as creative director of the video game group. We did all the ColecoVision entertainment titles. So, although I've only got actual design credits on a couple of games, I had a hand in doing every single entertainment title that Coleco did during that time period, from the time ColecoVision came out until Coleco shut down their electronic entertainment department. There's a forgettable year of working for another small company after that, and then 7 years of freelancing, again, as an illustrator, a game designer, a writer, an editor, and a computer game designer. A couple of the titles he didn't mention was 4x4 Off-Road Racing through Epix. And I was the designer on Interplay's Lord of the Rings Volume 1, both as a freelancer. That career segued into a career as a fantasy illustrator for TSR doing book covers. That's where id found me, and after that I worked on Quake 2, Quake 3, Quake 3 Team Arena, and now working on Doom. My background has been what I'll call a synthesis of all the things that I have done. And level design, especially the way id does it, is a synthesis production. It's a variety of experience. Everything that a level designer at id does a lot of things. He's not somebody's hands. executing someone else's design, nor is he someone who sets out a design for someone else to do. My art experience for fantasy illustration, which really Quake 3 Arena was, is a fantasy product, where some designers will steep themselves in reference. I already had 20 years of steeping myself in this type of reference we use to do levels. Also, as a, since the other aspects of the game, I worked as a writer on Team Arena and Quake 3 Arena. Just about everything that was written that came out with the game, I either wrote, outsourced, edited, or worked to develop it with our two programmers.
Awesome. Eric?
Well, I'm not as... I haven't been around as long as Mr. Jenkweiss here, so mine was pretty quick. I was born in the huge metropolis of Oshkosh, Wisconsin, with no hope of ever getting a job at all in a game industry. I grew up playing the stuff that Paul worked on, all the role-playing games. I eventually ended up at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I got a degree in English. I wanted to be a technical writer. A friend of mine was a programmer for Raven. They needed someone to write a script. I fell into that job, turning a script. That game kind of fell apart. I ended up building levels. This was around the time when there were no such thing as level designers. It was just design. And I've been there ever since. So, nice, and that's about it.
Go over to the realistic side. Start with Dario.
Does this work? Yeah. Still? Great. My past wasn't quite as in-depth as Paul's either. It actually started when I was 19, which wasn't all that long ago, when I played Doom. Bought the latest version of PC Gamer, and suddenly we could make our own levels, and that's where it all started. So I would have to say that I started really, really entrenched in the fantastic design. I designed levels for Doom, for Quake, mainly distributed for free over the internet, but luckily I secured the contract with id on Final Doom. But this was really, really fantastic design, and nothing to do with reality, no physics involved, it was just purely what I imagined. After that I moved on to Half-Life, which was really, really, you know, the total opposite, strictly realistic design, which is a real kick in the pants for me. It's really hard to just go from one world to the other straight away. But it sort of changed my focus on what I really like to do. And now, the current project was Team Fortress 2, which is really a mix, half and half, of sci-fi and realism. So it's kind of allowed me to draw from both parts of my background, which was, you know, 7 years total, anyway. But I tend to prefer the realistic design for many reasons, which I'm sure we'll come to later. But, so that's my background so far.
My name is Duncan Brown, and I was an architect for 10 years in New York before, I guess, Descent was my epiphany, and I really got into making game levels and surfing the web. I found there was a job at LucasArts that was looking for architects specifically, so I thought, hey, why not? And I've been there for almost 5 years now. In terms of addressing the question as to how much my background played in my most recent project. My last project was Battle for Naboo on the N64, and the first level that I had to design was the speeder chase through Theed. There was a lot of reference material from the movie and also from sort of books and other CDs that had been published, so we were able to reference those and find out what the architecture of the city of Theed was actually like. We sort of knew just from other sources that the designers of the movie had been looking at Turkish and Moroccan references, so we researched those too. And then there had been a large model built of Theed for the movie, and that was sort of a series of objects, models made by the model shop, and they were pretty much placed down on a flat plane. So the task that you have as a level designer or and also as an architect is to give the level a sense, sort of a sense of space and a feeling that you're actually in a real place. So that is sort of what the task was for the project. And I think it's every architect's dream to design a city. So in some respects, the Thede level answered that dream. Thank you.
Cool. The next question is, do you strive for realism in your designs, or do other considerations take priority? I think we heard a little bit already from the realism side and whether these guys, what they shoot for. We'll jump over and see what these guys shoot for when they're doing their designs. Let's start with Eric.
I guess I'll go first. Well, I think that the main priority for any game has to be fun. If you're not thinking about the gameplay when you're designing your level, then what's the point of even making a game? You can just go and make pretty pictures of buildings. That is a key for everything that, as a level designer, that you're going to want to work for. But I do agree that to an extent you need to understand, especially for the type of game you're creating. When we were working on Soldier Fortune, we wanted it to be a believable world setting, but we still had to make it so that it was fun. And, I mean, in the real world, you could go wherever you want. There still has to be a way to lock people in. And we tried to stay away from a lot of locked doors. I also think that, for the most part, reality tends to be on the boring side. There's plenty of showcase buildings that you can go and see. Like this building here, it's a really nice architectural building. It's pretty to look at. But for the most part, your office building is going to be a bunch of cubes in a square, and everything is square. So when we design, specifically at Raven, I should say, we really tend to think grounded in reality, but not worry too much. A lot of vigorous design meetings, we'll have someone go off and start a level. We'll tell them what location it is, what style it is. They'll create it, and they'll come back to us, and we'll all get in a big round table, and we'll discuss why it looks wrong or if it looks right. And essentially, it really does come down to the gameplay. So
you guys go with more of an intuitive, like, does it look right?
Yeah.
Just from a,
yeah, everything is eyeballed at Raven.
From playing the game.
Yeah. And even if something is a little wrong, if it's fun, then we'll tend to keep it in over the fact that it looks a little wrong.
Okay.
Paul, you want to talk?
Yep, I'll talk. When designing, I usually have three concerns. First, the level should play well. It should be something, as Eric said, it's fun. Second, it creates as attractive a play environment as the engine is capable of making and still preserving an acceptable frame rate. Now, different people have a different definition of what's acceptable, but we generally go for something that, again, forces that that plays toward appearance sometimes more than it'll play to trying to get that 100 frames per second rate. And then third, I try to create spaces that are interesting to me, that look to be fun to play. And generally, if playing them a couple times, they play out, then I'll try and go the next step, make them look a little better. But one of the things I try to do is not imitate myself going from map to map.
All right. Jump over to you guys now. Sorry. Kind of answered the question. You guys, I think you both kind of covered it pretty well. But
you want me to re-ask the question?
Okay. If you guys have any more you want to talk about, or I can just
go to
the next one. Okay.
I was going to say that as well as realism, there are obviously considerations like gameplay and theme. And I think that gameplay is the most important thing, which is what Paul touched on. It wasn't Paul, it was Eric. Just for example, we had a part of Half-Life that we wanted to put in was this enormous hydroelectric dam, because it seemed like an impressive thing to do, and possibly we could have the helicopter going and everything else. So we built a full-scale replica of this dam, and it was sort of, I don't know, 700 yards across or something, and we jumped in there, and it was just the most boring thing in the world to have to run across the other side. So, you know, realism, just we thought, well, just as long as it looks like a dam and it's exactly it plays the way we want it to play, then we don't really need it to be, you know, this exact blueprint copy of a DAM. But still, there are so many fundamentals that you have to take into account when you're building something that's supposed to look realistic, and people need to realize when they see it, okay, that's what you were intending it to be. And if you're going to break laws of physics or architecture, then you're just going to lose the immersiveness that the player should, you know, really be requiring if you're putting them through the realistic situation in the first place. A good general rule is if in the game your characters are obeying the laws of physics, like if you can jump and you come back down straight away, then there's sort of, there's normal laws of physics going on, then so should your geometry. You don't want to have geometry that looks like it was built for, say, low gravity, yet your characters are obeying the laws of gravity, because that just kind of destroys the illusion of the world you're trying to create. The final point I want to make about the realism and design is if you're creating fantastic architecture, you want to have a sort of a consistency, which means if the game is as fantastic in the beginning, then it should be fantastic all the way through. I mean, unless you've moved them between different worlds and things, you don't want to start changing the rules midway just because you've forgotten about the rules that you were trying to adhere to in the first place. So consistency, I think, is really important as well as the gameplay and the thing that you're trying to adhere to. I think reality takes a back seat to all three of those.
Just to reiterate a few points there too, perhaps. I think there's a reality that exists in our everyday lives, and many games try and replicate or even simulate that sort of thing, where, you know, the death animations are real, there's sort of grime on the textures, there's dust in the air, that sort of thing. But I think there's also a sense of realism that extends to fantastic environments too, a realism that allows alternative environments, and that realism is related to the idea of consistency and sort of completeness. The realism means that you're sort of fully taken in by the environment, and it's a completely immersive environment.
So, Paul, do you worry about things like structure, loads, or spans, or other engineering problems when you're designing your levels, or do you just, through iterative gameplay, do you just go with what looks good, plays right?
Level design is really all about illusion. We aren't creating real worlds. We're creating the virtual equivalent of theme parks and movie sets. The attention to detail that's required to build a map shouldn't focus on engineering, you know, the being engineering accurate. It should look to the player like it could do the job. And so that can be choice of materials and an approximate placement of structures that are expected to be there. So the answer is no, I don't think it needs to be engineering accurate.
Eric?
You're probably going to guess I'm going to say no, that I don't pay any attention to that either. I don't really know the actual weight of a pixel or a texture or a brush, and since we change textures a lot, I'll build something or a designer will build something and we'll look and we'll say, you know what, that looks like it should be stone or that should be wood, and we'll change accordingly. I think that a lot of it depends on the game you're building too. If it is a totally fantastical game, run free, do whatever you want. It's all eye candy. If it's a more realistic game, we don't really worry about load and span or structure, but we do, of course, take into effect. We use a lot of pictures off the net or architecture that you can actually go and look at. We use a lot of concept sketches, a lot of artwork. And the biggest thing is that we just, like I said before, we make it so it's going to be fun, but it needs to be visually appeasing. So, appealing.
All right. Darren?
Structure, loads, and spans, I think you don't really have to deal with it in such close detail that an architect would see it and say, yeah, that's a real structure, unless your game is aimed at lots of architects playing it.
But I think that paying this sort of attention to detail lends credibility to your environment. I mean, it's really important. You can get so much atmosphere just out of your environment before you put anything in it. Just because people they're in a place where they're familiar with and everything, you can get so much suspension of disbelief if the player believes he's an environment that he's familiar with. So it's hard for you to get the player to believe in this world you're creating if he doesn't have to overlook these obvious impossibilities in your designs. Because if there's a huge bridge with really chunky supports and the correct spans, or I'm not an architect, so I can't really speak in those terms, but it's pretty obvious looking at a design and telling whether it's feasible or not. And then if it's not feasible, but it's part of this world that you're expecting the player to believe in, then I think that really lets you down as an overall design. But as far as the architectural details of structure, load, and span, it's really who you want to play the game. You don't have to get that detailed if people are just a bit more casual about the environment than experts.
I don't think you have to pay too much attention to things like structure, load, and spans in terms of engineering details. But people do have a very natural sense of what looks right, and whether whether something will stand up, or whether, say for example, you were designing a bridge, you could design that so it was very sturdy, it looked strong, you wouldn't even think about crossing over it. But on the other hand, you could also design it so that it looked flimsy, and it was going to be a very sort of frightening experience to cross that bridge. So I think there's two ways of looking at how you address the sort of technicalities of structure. And the other thing I was going to say is, if you're working in a sort of a science fiction environment, there's lots of outs for you in terms of explaining the technology that's used to make something stand up or act as support. On the racing game that I worked on, Racer, we had sort of glass tubes that went underneath the ocean on the planet of Acularis. And there, those were explained in terms of they were transparent steel, which doesn't exist in this world, but certainly exists in the Star Wars universe.
All right, we kind of touched on it already. The next question is, does the player care or even notice? Is there a suspension of disbelief lost when something doesn't look right? One example I usually like fall back on when I think about this is, we've all played games in office spaces or warehouses or, sort of like a hospital even. And they're like really mundane, even in this building, there are, exit signs every certain number of feet, and these are required by codes. These are pretty mundane things, but is this something that the player cares about when they play your game, or is this something that you guys can kind of not really pay attention to? Eric?
Again, I'm going to bring up Soldier of Fortune. We tried to make it as realistic as possible, but you have to keep in effect poly count and how fast you want your levels to run. So snapping in an exit sign everywhere, it's believable, but those polys you can save to have an extra enemy or, a portion of an enemy on the screen. I think that there is something lost in, like he was talking about the bridge. If you see this massive bridge that spans in this huge drop-off, if there's little ropes holding it up, definitely the player's going to kind of be taken out of the game a little bit. But for the most part, I think that if it's something that you don't catch, one of your coworkers will catch it. Hopefully one of your coworkers will catch it. And if they don't, then hopefully QA will catch it. And then if they don't, then you'll be laughed at. But for the most part, there's a definite suspension of disbelief if you miss specific things that I think it's kind of inherent that you would realize you need to put in.
Well, I'm going to kind of take a different approach on it because at least the topic. The player does care about not necessarily attention to detail as much, but they care about the appearance of your product. They just spent anywhere from $200 to $600 on a new video card, and they want to see your game put that card through its paces. they're already bringing a fair, just as being gamers, they're already bringing a fairly healthy suspension of disbelief. They're pretty much ready to accept your world. They just really want it to look great. They may eventually turn the graphics down to Pikmin 5 to play it in tournaments, but initially they want to see just this great-looking map, and they're more concerned that it just looks good than if it, every little detail's in place.
Cool. Dario, what do you think?
Yes, I absolutely agree with what Paul was saying. But I have noticed in the past that the environment that you're creating can really talk to the player about what he should be experiencing or what might be coming next. And by breaking rules and by changing rules, you can be warning the player of that. For example, just say you're walking along maybe a catwalk or something, and there's a crack in the side of it that as you walk along you'll see it, then you're sort of expecting the catwalk to be weak, and then something can happen to break the catwalk if he's not careful. So you can always use the environment to really add to the game or to bring out things that perhaps the player would be just thrown into unwary had you not used the environment and broken a few of the rules that you really strictly adhere to for the rest of the time. And Quake is obviously a very, very different game to Half-Life, and their environment is very, very much like a rich environment, lots more colors, lots more wild shapes. But they don't do the same kinds of things that we really, really needed with our environment. And by bending and breaking a few laws here and there, you can really, really tell or warn the player of what's coming up next. But as far as whether they even notice the details that's going on, I think that they might not be able to tell you why they really appreciated what was happening in the environment, but I think it really adds to the experience subconsciously if you have this consistent adherence to theme. I mean, I always think of the movie that was made in the, I think, the early 80s with David Bowie called Labyrinth. Like, they had these staircases going up and around and left and right, and they were walking up and down them, and it just broke every law of physics because the whole film was consistent like that. The context was presented so well that you immediately believed that this was possible. And, you know, even though it wasn't that realistic, it was just a really consistent theme. So that, I think that's really important too.
I think there is a suspension of disbelief lost when something doesn't look right. But I think it depends on the game genre. I think action arcade players are going to be a lot more forgiving of flimsy polygon walls in a building that they've just blown up, as opposed to someone in a first-person shooter who's going to look for things like detail and thickness in their spaces. So, yes, I do think it is important.
All right. Eric, you talked about saving polygons. What about now? I mean, I'm sure your programmers are promising you a little more room to play. Do you still think that has the expectation of hyperrealism changed your design strategy?
It has. I think that more so than saving polygons, every new card that comes out, you're always going to build a game that pushes it to its limit. Because like Paul said, when you buy a card as a consumer, you want to get all the bells and whistles for it. Most of our games that we've been putting out lately have been very scalable, so that newer cards can take advantage of everything in the game. And if you have an older card and don't feel like shelling out $600 for a new one, you can tweak it down so that your game is just as good as gameplay-wise as this super card, but you just don't get all the whistles and bells. I think the biggest concern that we have, we're more concerned with scale now, especially in a realistic setting, where before, like in Heretic, we would have 200-foot-tall doors that were, you know, 6 feet thick, and they would rise up, and no one cared because you're in a fantasy setting. As soon as you get into Soldier and you have a 200-foot-tall door that's 6 feet wide, what is going to open that? And, you know, they'd need bulldozers to pull that open. So I think along with that goes the scale of your characters. Once you build a level and you have it door scaled correctly to the height of walls and stuff, you throw a character in there, and if you're not working with your artist and the character is 3 foot tall and your door is 8 foot tall, there's definitely, again, the suspension of disbelief. You just need to make sure that your entire team has a unified scale, unified setting, 16 pixels equals a foot, whatever you want, just so that everyone is on task to build the same game and you don't automatically lose the player's interest because, you know, everyone is much smaller than what they should be and people instantly realize it's not a realistic setting.
For us, the living with John Carmack means that the hyper-realism issue is that it's been more creeping up on us slowly. Every project from Quake 2 forward, we've added a little more to what we do. Quake 2 was built with very simple brush structures. Quake 3 Arena, we moved to more complex brushes. We added the complexity of patches and curves and started including models to flesh out the worlds more. So every product, every level, we move just a little bit more towards complexity. The way we've been dealing with it, especially as we go forward into Doom, is to start subdividing the tasks of doing the levels. It used to be pretty much one man, one level, with the artists coming in and providing support textures. With Quake 3 Arena, we moved through a process where the artist did a rough cut on the level, got it to a point where the level designer got it to a point where we had a good look, what he thought was a good looking level and played well in his terms, and we passed it off to the art team for a restyling. The artist would then do a few areas, get it to look, say, okay, this world, the way I've added more detail, more refined texture use, and we pass that back to the level designer. As we go forward, we're actually looking at subdividing the workload even more across more people so that we do parts of a level that can be self-contained, pass it off to an artist we're teamed with, and then it'll come back again for adding in the gameplay elements. So we're actually, and then we've got some ways, if anyone's seen the Doom video, we've got some ways of...
Has anyone seen that?
We've got some ways where we're dealing with creating the appearance of more detail without actually doing it.
Wow. That's cool. Dario? Or Duncan?
As far as whether the expectation of hyper-realism has changed our design strategies, I actually don't think it has changed it that much. I mean, the fundamental design process we've always had is an artist does interesting concept sketches and then we try to build whatever it was that was sketched beforehand. I think as we get more and more polygons and more resources to use, we just have fewer and fewer excuses as to why it doesn't look as close to the sketch as it should be. I think it's a deal about the implementation is going to have to be really strict now. It's not a matter of, well, your sketch, if I built it, it would be 60,000 polygons, so I can't do that, because, you know, in about 6 or 7 months, we'll be able to build that many polygons. So I think it's going to be a lot more work for the level designer. And as Paul was saying, the only thing you can really do is to subdivide work amongst maybe modelers who can put in models which are very, very scalable within the world, or even divide the level up between people. The other thing is that you have to be really clear to be on the forefront of graphic technology. There's no point in starting your design now because it takes 18 months to complete a game, maybe 2 years, in which case, by which time, your designs will be hopelessly out of date. So if you author probably for the highest end platform available today being your base, then it's a pretty good thing to go for, I think.
I think the expectation for hyperrealism has made our design process more complex. And as people have already said, it's begun to involve larger teams for the creation of the game. It certainly slows down the process as you have to give more attention to detail and construction of your levels. But I think it also means that you can do puzzles that are more realistic as you get more realistic physics and lighting and stuff like that. And whereas before you might be limited to just running around and collecting keys, you can now actually do puzzles that involve mechanical equipment or it's completely altering environments.
Yeah, I'm gonna start with going with you. Are there any shortcuts, Duncan, to creating this detailed look in the game?
I would say sort of use of real-life references. You have a lot of good source material, whether it's historical or sort of geographical. You can use realistic, photorealistic textures, just going out and taking photographs, capturing images. And I think one of the key shortcuts in the future is going to be reuse of models that you've made in the past and can reuse in later projects. So they're sort of very strong database of old models becomes very important.
What about the division of work, like Paul said? Do you guys have any, can you talk at all about any kind of structure and how to build a level?
That again depends on the game and also the team that's making the game. It varies from project to project. Sometimes if it's a sort of action arcade, shooter, there might be more opportunity for the level designer to do the work themselves, but as it comes towards RPGs and first-person shooters where the environments have to be more detailed and complex, then it does get into sort of complicated time management and people management in terms of who makes what and how that gets integrated with the game.
Dario?
I would also say that an increased dependence or maybe codependence on technology that your programmers are creating. For our latest game, we've got a whole lot of new tricks that have been developed over the last 12 months that we would have had to really work around in the first sort of 18 months of programming Half-Life. I mean, things like cubic skyboxes, which is just basically a 3D skybox, which you can stand on the top of a skyscraper and look around, and there's this huge city that we didn't build. It was created with an environment map, and it looks great. And, you know, in the old days, we wouldn't even consider trying to build a city because there's too many polygons. And just a programming trick like that can just be so useful to you. A lot of other programming tricks, you can use like a material system where you can have just a mirror on the wall that will reflect whatever's in front of it. You know, you don't have to do anything. You just place it there where you want. Materials look wet or dry depending on what you decide. Physics, as you were talking about, a ragdoll explosion is simply if you have a model of a car and you set off an explosion under it, the engine does all the effects for you. You don't have to program a train that'll move here and there and rotate here, you know, that looks completely unrealistic. And again, we have to do, as level designers, we have to do virtually no work to set it up, and it's just all there. Particle effects is another really great environment additive that we basically have to do no work for, but really, really pays off. So working with programmers is basically our responsibility. And the closer you work with them, the more creative use you can have and the more optimization that gets with these programming toys. And those are real, real shortcuts that they save so much time, and because they're endlessly reusable, you know, you don't get duplication of effects where one doesn't really look quite like the other. And that's all very, very helpful.
Okay. I'm going to reiterate kind of something they both said, is build once, reuse often. Work with modular prefabs. Do as much of your level design out of pre-built map sections as you can. That can include, if you're using map geometry or models, arrangements of furniture, just things you can grab out of the library, like Duncan said, in place in the map. Use real detail sparingly. Use it only where it counts in the map, where you can actually put your eye on it. Fake the rest with clever use of textures. Division of labor. Many hands carefully managed make light work.
I think that our biggest thing that we're really getting into now as a development house is every level that we create that has a main focal point, we concept out what that level is going to be, what that location looks like, what the focal point is. That saved us a lot of time because it instantly puts your level designer, your artists, your modelers, and your programmer on the same page. They can look at this piece of concept work and they all know what's expected, and it still allows for a little bit of freedom. Everyone's involved in the creation of it, but it really, and a day of planning will get rid of a week of just random work. We also, I mentioned the unified scale, that it's a really important thing, where if you can talk in feet instead of pixels, for some reason, feet, since we use them all the time, or we use it as a measurement all the time, it's easier to say, build me something that's 8 feet tall, and the designer knows, oh, okay, that's this many pixels, and the artist knows, okay, that's this many pixels, and it just works together. Instead of, since texture resolution is getting larger and larger, having to go to an artist and say, I need, you know, 1024 by 1024 for my 4 foot tall pillar, just say 4 foot tall, and he'll know what it is, which doesn't directly equate to what it is in the design. And I totally agree with what these guys said before about prefabs. They're a lifesaver. And the last thing that I would really say are facades. Fake everything. Play if it's beyond the player's view or the player can never get to it, as long as it looks realistic from where you are, let the textures do the work. It's a great way to really let the players think that they're in a larger environment than what they're really in.
You meant looks good, not looks realistic.
I know you guys aren't on the HR team or anything, but given the increasing complexity of level design, what do your companies or teams look for in a new designer?
I think that despite this in increasing complexity and such like, I don't think that the general skill set really changes at all, and you're still, as a level designer, somewhat a jack of all trades. But first and foremost, I think a level designer would need ideas about and an understanding of gameplay. That's, you know, first and foremost, always the most important thing. Then a great ability to visualize space in real 3D. That is, so you're not just sort of working, you know, horizontally in two dimensions, but you have an idea of how a level could be developed in three dimensions, fully in three dimensions, so there's also sort of vertical movement, and you make use of, you know, that dimension of space as well. I think in terms of these larger teams that we're all having to get involved with, and also the sort of changing roles that a level designer has within those teams, you also need to be very flexible. And along with the flexibility comes a sort of certain ability to be diplomatic. So I've also said that a level designer would need an extensive background knowledge of games, both past and current games.
I would add a few of things to those, but this is mainly more technical aspects of the skills that we look for. In no particular order, coping with stress is really important, because when you get down to the last 6 months of a product cycle, you work really long hours, and there'll be some times where you really hate the product you're working on, or who you're working with, or the technology. It breaks every 24 hours and you get really frustrated, so stress management is pretty important. Reacting positively to feedback is just as important. It's an endless cycle when you're going through. You've built something, it can always be improved no matter how much time you spend on it, and the longer and the closer you are attached to this thing, the harder it is to receive really adverse feedback. I mean, sometimes you'll get an artist's opinion and he won't be diplomatic at all, and you've got to be the one who diplomatically receives it. If you just sort of get into an argument, you know, nothing's going to be achieved by that feedback session. I think you touched on the multitasking thing. At any one time, I can remember myself maybe handling 8 to 10 levels at once and a lot of different aspects to each level. And you have to be able to switch from one thing to another really quickly without, you know, having to say, well, I've got to take an hour to get over what I just did, and then now I can start on the next thing. Yeah, you have to really multitask. Independent work ethic, it sounds pretty obvious, but the more time you can spend on something you really want to do, the more effective you're going to be. It's not a matter of, well, I'm going to come in, I'm going to spend 10 hours a day, so that means I did a good job. The better ethic is that I really want to work on this. I'd work on it at home if I was sick, for example. The last one, which is the hardest and the worst, is the motivation to complete really mundane tasks. Because believe it or not, well, everyone I'm sure knows, there's so many mundane things that have to go before you have a level which you've built and you're really excited because it looks great, and then one that's completely finished. there's a whole lot of really, really boring stuff that goes on there. And if you just like to pass that off to other people, then you're not going to be quite as valuable as that you should be. So the motivation for mundane tasks is another thing that I'd definitely encourage.
Okay. I kind of approached it from a different standpoint. What's id looking for? We're not looking for anyone right now, but compatibility. The most important aspect of a small development team is the team. You need to be able to get along and play well with others and be able to fit into the team's corporate culture. Something I always stress to people who are looking for a job is the ability to start, stay with, and complete assignments with minimal direct supervision. That means once you're given a task, you take it all the way to completion. Bring more than one skill to the team, or have more than one that you can develop. Previous experience. You've done this before for someone else. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean professionally. I always encourage newcomers to the field to get involved with mod teams. If you actually stick with it and complete projects, it's like doing real work. Maturity. This is something that the people who are in charge of level designers at id have always stressed. It's a good level designer, in our eyes, is someone with some life experience behind them already. And then it should come as obvious, familiarity with our tools helps a lot.
Well, I guess all I can say is that 7 years ago when I got my job, I walked in as a writer, and now there's no way that if you just have I can write some words, you're not going to get a job as a level designer. I could stress all the stuff that everyone already said, and as I look at my list, it's pretty much been covered, so we can just pretty much go over it then.
I'll give you the next question then. What can designers do to prepare themselves for the increasing graphic complexity in games, if we haven't covered this?
We touched on it, but I think that what Paul was saying, mods, experience, practice, one thing that it's kind of nice to do is find a place, find a location that looks challenging as a level, a real location, just to focus on the realism, and try to build it in an engine. Try to just take it out and create it pixel for pixel, keep it to scale. I think a big one, it's probably the toughest part of the job, is to play your competitors' games, all the time. Play every single new game. Okay, it's not that tough. Lastly, I think if you're constantly aware of your competitors and you watch what they're doing, playing their games, you're going to... you shouldn't copy. You should always strive to make it better. You know, look at what they did and really critically analyze what they've done. What don't you like about the product? What do you like about the product? And try to focus on that just from a design standpoint. And I guess the biggest of them all is just be aware of your surroundings, especially if you're working on a realistic game. Like Jake was mentioning, the exit signs. Okay, that's a good thing to have. Or, skylights, whatever. Pay attention to architecture around you and if that's what the point of the game is, try to build it as close to that as you can.
Okay. Actually, he covered very few of what I've got on mine. One of the things that's actually been brought up here that among this team, because I think we're all primarily first-person shooter type creators, is that the level designer has lots of things he does, and they're not all just placing brushes or building geometry. So I'm going to start out. One of the things that you can prepare yourself for now, because of the way that development is changing, is learn some model-making skills, even at a basic level. Familiarity with Max. If you haven't checked out GMax, go check it out in the discrete booth. Maya, Lightwave, or some higher-end tool is going to be a plus for future development. Make levels. Make lots of levels. Develop the technical familiarity with the tools and just have experience creating fun play areas. Learn basic texturing skills. There's going to be a lot of times when you've got this texture and you need it just a little bit different. And you could go to the artist or you could just dig into your art tool and make a couple of minor changes. Develop basic scripting skills. Most of the GUI games are going now is they're going to be becoming more complex scripting, and that's not going to be necessarily handled by your programmer. Technical writing skills. You're likely to be asked to document your work before you develop it. Communication skills, both verbal and written. Be comfortable with describing ideas. Learn to write and respond to emails without being inflammatory. And learn to play well with others. If I discovered that you are the person who is acting like an immature jerk online, I'd probably take a pass on hiring you, regardless of your talent.
Darren? Cool. Is that you?
Yeah, I won't ever be applying that. I actually just wanted to make a simple point, and it sounds pretty rhetorical, but I find this really helps for me a lot, is try to think of what you'd like to design rather than what you think is possible to design when you're considering new projects. It's way too easy to be back in the last project's technological cycle. Every time a game comes out and you start designing a new one, there's so much more you can do in that you didn't do in the last, and it's really easy to get stuck in the rut of the last one. I think, well, I can do the same kind of thing but add a bit more detail to it. Now, you should be really, really just focusing on what you think you'd like to design rather than what used to be possible with a little more detail, because then you can sort of get out of that box that you've been in for 2 years or whatever it was to take however long it took to design the first project, and then your next one will be like this big step rather than just a small evolution.
I think I really only can reiterate some of the things that Paul has already said, Dario has already said, in terms of you should try and become familiar with one of the higher-end software packages like Max or Maya and really get to know how to model beyond the lowest level of detail. I think that's something I'm finding now. I can sort of block out spaces quickly using some of our original tools. But now to actually sort of take the next step and be able to model in something like Max or Maya at a higher level of detail, that's sort of the next challenge. You should also see what people are doing, other people are doing in terms of their games, in terms of creating effects, and what sort of event scripting it is that people are able to do. And then once you've sort of had a look at those, you can maybe create your own prototypes for something that you might like to do in the future too.
Okay, this is the last question, and we'll try to get some questions in for these guys from the audience. Paul, what kind of strategies can teams use to handle the challenge of increasing complexity in level design?
Get away from the idea of one guy, one level. Be ready to surrender ownership so that it's a team project, not a personal project. Communicate. Take a proactive approach to working with team members. Design in a way that you get your other team members excited about continuing the development and improvement of the level, not just fleshing out your ideas. And then plan. But recognize that, like in battle, a good battle plan usually has to be tossed out. It doesn't survive contact with the enemy.
Eric?
I think the biggest thing is intensive, what we call pre-design. That's where everything's written out, drawn out, concepted out. We make sure the whole level is, you know, as fleshed out as it can be. And as Paul said, things are going to change. But if you have the basic fundamental of what you're working with, it really saves a lot of time and allows you to get your projects done, you know, hopefully close to as on time as you can. Another thing we do is we have weekly design meetings where we get all of our designers together, and every once in a while we even drag in an artist kicking and screaming to force him to look at, or her, to look at their textures and what the designers are doing to them. Concise planning. Make sure that there's not someone who's sitting around waiting for something. If you make sure all your leads or all your, you know, art, design, sound, programming, they're all together, and they all know what is expected of your internal milestones or your external milestones, it's the best way to do it. And then lastly, we found that when you work in multiple passes, where you have architecture, okay the architecture, now let's light it and make sure it's okay. If that doesn't work, let's redo the architecture. Build it in stages. And like Paul said, we have different people that will try to, they have stronger skills in some of those fields, so we'll let them take a crack at it if it's not working from the designer who's actually in charge of that level. And that's all I wrote.
Dario?
I think Paul made some really good suggestions, and I would have said all of those. So what I've got left to say is, I don't know what kind of position you would give him, but a get things done guy. We had a sound programmer who, towards the end of the project, ran pretty dry on what he had to do. So he would sit behind level designers, and as problems came up or requests for technology or art or something, he would then leave the room and expedite their implementation or deny them and then set you back on track. So, because you can get really hung up on kind of the grassroots of design. You're in there moving bricks around and moving monsters around. You don't want to have to run between artists and programmers and management and, you know, ask, oh, I need this, I need that. So to have a guy there who's sort of extracted from the design processes but is just there to help you out, he can really speed things up and he can really help you so you don't have to be, your mind doesn't explode with too many different things.
We're going to wrap it up here pretty quick, I guess.
I don't really have much to add other than say the sort of advanced prototyping of levels is key for responding to the challenge of increasing complexity. Then also the clear definition of roles within a team in terms of artists and level designers, programmers, how the workload is divided up. And then also sort of probably most important of all is just having a clear art path in terms of smoothing things along. I think people want to get on to questions.
Okay, thanks, Luca. Do we have time for a few questions? Is that? Is there anything else in this room afterwards? Or? Yep.
The edge?
Yeah.
That actually wasn't my map.
Next question, in the back.
Where did you get the concept for the edge map?
Sorry.
The designer who's kind of sitting down here in front says it's from an old Doom map. And a lot of original contributions.
In the back there? Yeah, I'm not sure I can sum that one up.
Summarize the question.
I'm not sure I can. Can you sum that up in a shorter? Sorry.
Okay. Okay. So like, what I mean with pre-production is like actually figuring out the first 100 examples you want to have before starting the group and like post the project.
Okay. So what kind of pre-production? Okay. So how much?
I think I can get that. You're saying, well, essentially, you have to rely on what your programmer is telling you. If they tell you that you're going to have a feature and all of a sudden it falls through, that could, I mean, spell doom for a project. So at the beginning of a project, we have research and development who we prototype out a bunch of stuff, so that we'll know if it works or if it won't work. And that includes how many polys on view, how many, you know, how fast, what our minimum machine is going to be, and we really try to stick to that as close as possible. Does that answer your question? Or?
I see. You're asking when you're not really slated to have, okay, have this level done in 2 weeks and this week, you know, before you're really on a full-time project, how much research and R&D time do you spend just developing your level design skills? I'm thinking that's what he's...
Yeah, well, I think that Raven is, we always seem to end up getting really tight design schedules or game schedules in general. So we don't have a lot of... It all depends on who your publisher is and how much time in your schedule. If there's a nice big buffer zone, you have plenty of time. You know, you need to schedule it out in advance. Am I totally... Yeah. So
yeah,
if you know you have this much time... You can take this much of it just for research and development and making sure things work. And it's always in your best interest to nail gameplay, like how people are going to react, what's going on, as soon as you can. And that's hopefully usually done at the beginning of a game, instead of building in a vacuum and not really just building levels and hoping that something's going to work correctly. That's not the right way to do it at all.
All right. Grab one more, I guess, before we got to get out of here. Right out front here.
Yeah, I was wondering if, real quick, if we could get a sort of a definition on what sort of like fantasy we're talking about here and what sort of realism we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
From either each side or possibly from the moderator.
Oh.
That's moderator country.
Moderator country? I don't know. Let's see. I guess the really just wanted to get these guys together to talk about how important, you know, reality or portraying right reality is to their design, and what kind of drives, what ingredients drive their design strategies when they're making a level. And obviously it's different for every game, and that's kind of why we try to get guys from different background, different types of games. I mean, obviously, you know, Paul's got a different set of rules than Dario for making his levels. Just for how it's weighted, I guess. I'm not sure if I'm answering the... Okay.
You can ask us later, Brandon.
Should wrap it up, but last one?
I think it will definitely help, and just by nature of their training too, I think architects bring a lot of the sort of team player sort of training that is required on a lot of larger projects now. So yes, it helps, but I think gameplay, as everybody's saying, is always very, very important.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, you guys.